think he's even here.
I'll call the February 5th, 2007 session of the House Committee on Workforce and Economic Development to order. Today we're going to have a informational meeting on workforce development in the construction industry. And I'd like to call up, first of all, Bob Shiprat from the Oregon State Building Trades.
Yeah. Good morning, Bob.
Start on time.
Yeah. Welcome.
Not like when you were here. Is that
correct? Yes. Well, most of his members have been at work now for about an hour.
Yes, they have.
And Bob's raring to go.
I'm Bob Shiprat. I'm Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I was invited this morning to hit some points and answer any questions you may have about our workforce training programs and just some industry people here. I'm expecting one of my apprenticeship coordinators to show up, Dan Campbell, with the electricians out of the Central Oregon. But I'll start. I obviously know the topic a little bit. I'm a product of our apprenticeship programs. That's what we use for training in Oregon and most of the country. We're what's known as a SAC state, in that the state regulates the apprenticeship programs in other states. About half of them, it's regulated by the federal government. And we like the SAC program, and it's all regulated through the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And all of the trades have an apprenticeship program, at least in the union sector in Oregon. They're quite vibrant in that the programs last anywhere from 2 to 5 years, depending on the trade. The state requires that every apprentice get at least 144 hours of what we call classroom training. You literally go into a classroom, you study safety, codes, blueprint reading, you may learn, do some welding, just all kinds of different things, again, depending on the craft. And the rest of the time is spent in on-the-job training, and after you reach the required number of hours of on-the-job training, which I should mention is closely monitored by what we call the Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committee, you actually fill out every month a record of all the tasks that you've done. And then the committee looks at that and they watch and make sure you're getting the right amount of training in every type of phase of your craft. And they may say, well, you're not getting enough of, well, I'll use my own trade, for instance. You're not getting enough low voltage experience. We're going to move you over here. Or they'll tell the employer, you know, Bob needs more of this type of experience. So you try and develop a well-rounded journeyman when you get out. The other thing that I want to share with you that it's important that you know, the Joint Apprenticeship and Training Committees are, the reason they're called joint is that it's 50% labor, 50% management. These programs are jointly managed by labor and management. They sit on the committee, they oversee the program, they hire the instructors, they manage the program. It is absolutely separate from the union. In fact, it's set up, it's even set up legally so that their expenses are separate. So the committee meets and they develop and make sure the curriculum's correct. They get the bills paid. Most of us, by the way, in the union sector, we've got our own training facilities. So we used to use the community colleges, and it just really didn't work out. We take a lot of space. Some of the trades, it gets a little messy, you know, the bricklayers and plasterers, they're going to dust all over the place. So we have our own training facilities, which are really good. The way these things are paid for is every hour a person works, be they apprentices or journeymen, a certain amount of money goes into the training trust. And we can say it's collectively bargained, but in the building trades, whatever it takes to fund the apprenticeship, that's what they get. I mean, that's just the way it works. The committee, which is joint labor management, looks at what their costs are, what their expenses are, and maybe they'll recommend at the time of contracts being signed that maybe another 5 cents or 10 cents an hour go into the fund so that the programs are maintained. In my experience, in all the years I've been with the building trades, I have never once heard of a dispute over the money going into apprenticeship. Not once. It is so important to us that those programs be well funded and well run that it's not even an issue. So they will do that. Again, let me start before I get to what they're paid. That's always important. How do you get into the programs? That's always been a question a lot of people ask. And there's a variety of ways. Right now, it's fairly easy, but the committee, the Joint Labor Management Committee, kind of what they do is they look at the economy, and they have to kind of pull out a crystal ball. What is the economy going to look like for their craft in the next 2-3 years? So they'll talk to architects and engineers, public agencies, their own estimators. They try and gauge what the market's going to look like, because they have to guess how many new people to bring into the trade every year. Because the apprentice starts out at maybe 40% of a journeyman scale, it's not a lot of money. And I got to tell you, when I first started in the electricians, I didn't know if I was going to make it. I had my first kid, and it was desperate. It was very hard. And so we're both the union and the contractors are very cognizant that if you bring these young people into the program, we have to provide jobs for them. It's very important that they work. Otherwise, they're going to go away. You can't, obviously. You have to survive. So we're very careful in trying to gauge how many new people we'll need in these programs every year. And the electricians, my local, for instance, we bring young people in every 6 months, and we try and watch that economy. And frankly, it works pretty good. We don't occasionally we'll miss it. Usually, when there's a huge downturn, I remember the early '80s, everybody. Totally. I mean, the state economists didn't even see that recession coming. And we had a lot of people that we took in. We had a red-hot economy that just went like this. And we lost a lot of young folks at that time. Many of the crafts actually, I won't say shut their programs down, but just didn't take anybody because there wasn't any jobs. There wasn't a job for these people. So we widely advertise in all sorts of the media. There's word of mouth. The Bureau of Labor has fairs. I mean, you can't believe all the ways we attempt to attract attention to the programs. We have folks that go into the high schools and community colleges, and it's all widely advertised. So we have quite a bit of success getting people into the programs. There's a very active role right now in the recruitment of women and minorities that we're doing very well. I should have brought some reports. In fact, I'll leave some with the committee administrator of the percentages that we're getting of women and minorities in the trades. There's my man.
Sorry for my tardiness.
Traffic's bad this morning. I was just giving him a thumbnail sketch of the program, and I'll hand it off to you, Dan, or maybe they can ask some questions. But so we're actively recruiting. The last thing I'll talk about is you know, I've talked about the training, how you get in. I should finish. You go to the the trust, the JATC, and you apply for apprenticeship, and there's a variety of different methods that Dan's actually more familiar with than you. Some of the unions do differently to how you get accepted. But typically, at least in my local, you're interviewed by labor and management again. You're scored, you're ranked, you bring in your high school or college transcripts, and we do have a number of college graduates that enter the apprenticeship program. Once you're in, you then start to work. You're dispatched to an employer, and you begin the training process, and then you begin your school work. It'll be set up, and that varies too. So we used to do it. I used to go two nights a week after work. Some people go weekends. My local now, I think it's once a month. They bring you into the school on a Friday. So it's a real commitment of time and effort to be an apprentice. The last thing I'll talk about is as you hit those hours that are required, every 6 months you get a pay raise until you've hit the limit, be it 2, 3, 4, or 5 years of apprenticeship. So your wages actually go up pretty quick because you'll be getting a pay raise every 6 months because you've went up through your apprenticeship, as well as the contract terms of the collective bargaining agreement change. You'll also pick up those raises. So once you get started, the first year's tough financially. That's why, again, we want to keep our kids working. It's important. But once you get going, it you can make it then you can see the light. So, and I'll just stop there.
Thank you, Bob, very much.
I hope I do that. I just hit the high spots. And
we'll maybe what we'll do is, unless someone has a burning question, we'll finish with Dan Campbell and then open it up for questions and comments. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning, Chairman. I am Dan Campbell, Training Director for Central Electrical JATC, which is a program that's jointly operated by the National Electrical Contractors Association and the IBEW. In our program, we have about 230 apprentices, and they're spread across three different occupations in the electrical field. We have, our biggest group is in the inside wireman program, which leads to a general journeyman electrician's license. And that's about 160 of our folks. And the remaining 70 or so are split between our limited energy program, which is everything from alarm systems, fire alarms, security systems, through computer networking, data networks, telephone systems, HVAC, and a variety of low voltage applications. And our third program is a limited residential program where people learn how to wire houses and living complexes. I think, again, I apologize for my tardiness, but I heard Brother Shiprack explained quite a bit about how the apprenticeship system works. And as he pointed out, each program kind of operates under its own set of rules, but we have to live within the guidelines that are set for us by both the state and federal regulation. So we have some differences between programs, but there are more similarities than differences in the way that we select our apprentices. One thing that I'd like to point out about apprenticeship, and I think Bob kind of pointed to this as well, but these people, while they're getting their career education, are all also contributing taxpayers in our society, and they're making pretty good wages. A beginning apprentice in all three of our programs is making, I think the lowest is about $12.50 an hour, up to $13.50 an hour first day on the job. And so, excuse me, they're doing You know, they're earning pretty good wages. Some people may have had to take a cut, but for many of our apprentices, that's the most they've ever earned in their life. As Bob pointed out, time goes on, they get periodic increases, and by the time someone completes their five-year inside apprenticeship program, when he tops out as a journeyman, if he's working steady, which right now most of them are, they're going to be earning somewhere in the range of $65,000 a year. And, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at. Five-year education, but this is a five-year education that was largely without any expense to taxpayers. It's a five-year education in which they'll complete having earned over $150,000 during the time of their training. They're not going to wind up with big sums to pay off in college loan debt. Basically, they will have provided a fair share of taxes to the state of Oregon and to the federal government out of their wages during that time. So we're real proud of our system. We're real proud that it's self-supporting. At the same time, we've often wondered, especially when we hear the emphasis on career education from folks at the state level, the importance of training in high road occupations, high wage occupations, which we do a tremendous job at, why there isn't more support from the state for those programs. We hear that, well, we're putting our money for apprenticeship into the community college system. Unfortunately, when that happens, most of the money never gets down to the apprentices that are being trained. We've found from our experience that a lot of the community college system looks at that as a way to get a little more cash to operate many other programs. And certainly, I don't want to take away from what community colleges do. They're hurting for money, and in some ways I don't blame them. But at the same time, I've got to wonder why more of the funding that's generated by our apprentice registration at the college isn't actually going toward the support of those apprentices and their training. That's kind of the sum of my comments this morning, unless you have questions.
Thank you both very much. Questions or comments from our panel? Vice Chair Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here and providing this insight for us. Just as a disclosure, I have a nephew who teaches at the Plumbers and Pipefitters. So, I was the last comment you made about funding. How many? I have maybe two or three, if I may. About how many apprentices do you have in your classes right now? Not in the whole program, but in the classroom.
Our Representative Riley, through the chair, are you referring to in each separate class a group of apprentices under one instructor?
No, I'm talking about how many are in your program who are still in classes. In other words, I know you have 5 years of apprenticeship on the job.
Right. They're in class every year throughout their apprenticeship. We generally schedule classes about 180 hours a year from September through May. So they go at least one night a week and one Saturday a month, in some cases a little bit of additional time on top of that.
And so how many people are in the program?
About 230 currently. And that's our program that covers six counties in the Willamette Valley and three counties in Central Oregon.
A little follow-up, if I may.
Please.
And is there any capacity for more, could the industry use more if you were training them?
That's a real tough question. The industry could use more. However, there's a reluctance at times on the part of contractors to put on more apprentices than they feel that they can fully employ. So even though we do a very good job of keeping our apprentices fully employed, if a contractor doesn't have enough work for them, we very rapidly deploy them with another contractor so that they don't have a lot of downtime. We have the capacity to be training. Actually, we could be training twice the number that we are now. We're somewhat limited. We're funded currently on a cents per hour basis. So for every hour that a journeyman or apprentice electrician works under the collective bargaining agreement, the contractor pays into the training fund, and that's how we achieve our funding. With that money, we've managed to build a $3.5 million training center. We staff full-time and part-time instructional staff, and if we had more money, we certainly could increase our offerings, increase our staffing. But right now, we do a pretty creditable job with what we have.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For both of you mentioned the payment for training that comes out of the work. Can you give us an idea of what the range of that is? Is it a buck and a half an hour or 10 cents an hour? What is
well, it varies from program to program. In our program, contractors are paying 55 cents an hour for every journeyman hour and apprentice hour that's being worked.
I would say that's about the average from what my experience has been.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Representative Riley. I got most of my answers, with the exception of you talked about a training facility. How many training facilities do you have in the state, and where are they?
Well, each program kind of works by itself to develop their training centers. We have one main training center that sits down in Tangent, just south of Albany, and that covers most of the Willamette Valley once you get outside of the Portland metro area. And then we also share a facility with the plumbers and pipe fitters over in Redmond that covers our Central Oregon group. And that actually belongs to the plumbers and fitters, but we have an arrangement with them to use some of their space. So we have two locations that we do the bulk of our training. Other programs, the plumbers and fitters have jurisdiction statewide and actually part of California and part of Washington. I believe they've got about 13 training centers that they're associated with. Sheet metal workers are mainly in Portland. I think they do a little bit of training down in Eugene. They've got a tremendous facility in Gresham, actually. IBEW Local 48 has about a 54,000 square foot facility in it's out East Airport Way, about 4 miles east of the airport in Portland. The plumbers and fitters have I don't even know how many square feet. It's a huge facility in Tualatin, which is kind of their flagship facility. But then, as I say, they've got a beautiful training center in Eugene, a place in Redmond, and various other locations throughout the state. I believe they have one right here in Salem as well. And the other trades are generally pretty much one location per trade, and most of those are around the Portland area.
Follow up?
Yes.
Follow up. I represent House District 59. I had a young man in Spray or Mitchell or John Day. How would he hear about becoming a member of any one of the trade unions?
Well, that's a bit out of my jurisdiction, so I don't do a lot of outreach over into that area. I believe most of the area that you've described would fall under a local union that's actually up in Tri-Cities, Washington, either there or it could be out of Local 48, Portland's local, but we also have a small piece over in eastern Oregon around Ontario and points south that are administered out of Boise. So I know that all of our programs are doing something similar to what I do. I try to make contact with all of the schools in our jurisdiction at least twice a year. I offer our facilities for tours. I offer myself to come make visits to classes, which I do several times throughout the school year. Participate in career fairs whenever they're available. Those specific areas that you mentioned, I really can't speak to, but I am imagining that the same kind of outreach activities are probably happening over there. One of our frustrations has been just getting people in the schools to offer us as opportunities for kids who are looking for career paths, because I've got particularly one group of school-to-work coordinators that I see annually down in Lane County that it seems like every year when I go there, it's a surprise to them that there's such a wonderful thing out there that some of their students could go to, and they asked me after the presentation, well, you know, how come we haven't heard about this before? And I have a hard time myself with that question, because very often the people asking me that are the same ones that I saw sitting in the room last year when I was there. So it seems like a great opportunity, but it's not sticking too well. And I think there's a good reason for that. I'm guessing this, really, but I believe that what happens is very often people in schools, and that's everyone from the counselors to the teachers to the administration, all found a path to success through a four-year or greater college education. And so they have a hard time seeing that you can really be successful without following that same path that they followed. And, boy, I'm here to tell you, there are a lot of successful people who found their way into the building trades. And, as I mentioned earlier, while they were getting a terrific career education that opened just a variety of different doors that they could pursue later on, they didn't wind up in debt. They didn't wind up having to chase grants or scholarships while they were getting their education, and they came out of that education already with an established place in the occupation that they trained themselves for. And that's something that many people who come to us who already have completed a four-year college degree didn't find. So, as Bob pointed out earlier, we have a number of people in our program who have bachelor's degrees in a variety of different occupations, a couple of people that have graduated in recent years with master's degrees, one in mechanical engineering and one in chemical engineering, and they just found that they weren't being satisfied in those careers and ended up coming to us. So there's lots of opportunities.
Vice Chair Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions concerning the Bob, you mentioned, glad to see you anyway, Bob.
Good to see you.
We served together,
yes,
in the House and Senate. Anyway, you mentioned it requires 2 to 3 years. I'm not sure what people belongs to 2 years, and people belongs to 5 years. And also, Bob, you mentioned 144 hours, and while Dan mentioned about,
correct,
180 hours.
Correct.
I'd like to see the differences in it. Mm-hmm. And maybe a third, one of the questions is also you mentioned minorities also in this program.
Yes.
And what percentage of the minorities, that's in the definition of minority, does it include the women?
Mm-hmm. So I'll take them. The apprenticeship programs vary by craft,
from 2 to 5 years. The labors are, I think, the only two-year program. Then you've got, you go up from there, cement masons, and I want to be careful here. I think the painters, maybe the floor covers are 3, iron workers, bricklayers, and some others. I think boiler makers are 4. Electricians, plumbers, pipe fitters are 5. So that's the way they vary. I don't know what Paul's are.
3, I think.
3 or 4. Okay. That's why I wanted to be careful. The second question had to do with, I forget now.
Hours.
The hours. The state requires a minimum of 144 hours. That's the minimum. And many of the crafts, maybe all of them, go beyond that. They also, almost every craft, I should mention it's not just apprenticeship that we teach. Almost all the crafts through their training facilities also have journeyman upgrading classes because our industry keeps changing. So we bring our own journeyman back to school, and they get credit for that, and obviously they want to maintain their skills in their craft. And of course the contractors are very happy to see that. The last question had to do with the women and minorities under federal law, and Dan will, I know it pretty well, but each program is measured, is it annually or by for EEO?
Well, that varies somewhat depending on the capacity of the Bureau of Labor. They've found themselves shorthanded over the last few years, as many of you with some time in your seats probably recognize. The staffing at the Bureau of Labor has been greatly reduced over the last 10 years. So they've taken to doing a paper review of many of the programs, which basically amounts to a quick scan of records. And then about once every 3 years, assuming that they don't identify any big problems on that brief review, they will come back and do a more in-depth review where they actually come and pull selected files and go cover to cover on many apprentice files to verify that, well, a number of things. One is that we're making as strong an effort as possible to recruit women and minorities. I'll tell you, it has been a tough road. I've been in my seat now for about 18 years, and during that time, I think when I came on board, about 4.5% of the people in our program were women. We've had a tough time expanding that. Right now, it's about 6.5%. When I go out and face a group of kids in a classroom and mention the opportunities for young women, a lot of times I get sniggers and smirks, and you know, a lot of people in our society just think that there are some occupations that women don't fit into. I'm here to tell you that's not true. We've got the women who do come into our program are by and large very successful, and they wind up you know, the same wages that I talked about, the same benefits that I talked about, and the same long-term career opportunities are there for them, but we struggle trying to get them into our program. Minorities, I'm not sure why we've struggled so much with that. In the Portland metro area, the electrician program has done a pretty good job. I would say that we're probably below 8% on minorities overall in our program, although in the last few years we have been bringing in more Hispanics than we had previously. But it's still, we haven't done a real good job with that.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it varies. My experience, it varies greatly geographically. Uh-huh. The problem is nowhere near as hard for Dan as it is for Ken Fry in Portland. We just completed a review of Portland area construction projects, South Waterfront, for instance, where you see all the big cranes down there. 24% of the hours worked are by women and minorities on that project. 24%. So the goal was 20. So we've, in, at least in the Portland area, where there are minority populations, we're doing very well. But Dan's right. It's something we work hard at.
Very hard. Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Mr. Chairman.
And also, you mentioned in this program some master degree with chemical or engineering might be coming in, but what's the minimum requirement?
Minimum requirements are much lower than that.
We could all get in.
Yeah, we require a college education with a 2-point GPA or an equivalent GED. We require 1 year of high school algebra with a C or better average or the equivalent. There are a number of ways that you can meet that equivalency. For people who have struggled with that in the past, we've got a new opportunity. Our national organization has developed an online class that they can actually get on and take at their own pace, and we've seen some people be able to meet that requirement now within about 5 weeks by taking the online course. So we've tried to open it up to as many people as we can. At the same time, we're a very competitive in our program, and I think it's you know, a lot of people recognize the electrical, the plumbing, pipe fitting, the sheet metal, a few trades kind of as more desirable than some of the other trades, and so we have a lot of competition for the seats in our program. We probably have a qualified applicant for about every five. I take that back. Five qualified applicants for every position that we actually take into our program. So when they come through that process that Bob described a while ago, when they're interviewed by the management and labor representatives on our committee, and they have to present themselves well, and those people are looking for as much background as they can see. It's not always, the background they're looking for isn't always just more education or more direct experience in the trade. There's some intangibles that we're looking for. How are you going to be able to get along with other people? How can you understand verbal and written instruction? Are you going to be able to work on a team with not only other electricians, but other tradesmen out there in the construction world? And sometimes it's a tough job making those evaluations, but we go for the people that we think have the most likelihood of being successful in the trade. And as I said, sometimes it is that guy with the master's degree, but sometimes we take in kids pretty fresh out of high school.
Thank you.
Excuse me, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dan and Bob, great to see you here talking about apprenticeship. As you know, it's something that's I'm pretty fond of, having participated in a JATC myself, which is a joint apprenticeship and training committee for the carpenters. And so I thought I would just offer the committee just to follow up. Both of you gentlemen have covered the programs fairly well, I think. Just some nuances about the carpenters is they do have training facilities. To answer Representative Dahlem's question, around the state they have one in Bend, one in White City, Eugene, Salem, and our main facility in Portland. We also have a small facility in Coos Bay as well. And you know, with that, you know, I think the answer to outreach, I think Dan addressed that somewhat. It does get challenging. We have outreach through the employment department, through BOLI, and also the JADCs, as Dan mentioned, do a lot of outreach with the schools themselves. And you know, but it is tough. People don't really always recognize this as a viable option for folks. And, you know, historically part of the problem that has been alluded to, but really not, you know, expounded on really with trying to deal with this outreach into our high schools is the quality of people coming into this program. They're ranked when they go in, and you know, as Dan mentioned, they usually try to rank the best qualified first, or what they think people will be most successful. And historically, the school districts have seen the trades as an opportunity to put challenged youth into. And you know, it's we do a great job of trying through Job Corps and the youth council, trying to accommodate a certain percentage of people that can get through some programs like that. But all in all, you know, it takes a motivated person and somebody who is relatively good with math, if nothing else, to succeed in these programs. They have to be highly motivated, because it isn't easy to you know, it sounds good, you know, learn while you earn, and it's the greatest model, I think, but it takes a lot of commitment from the apprentices, you know, and the nuances are all different between the trades. I know in the carpenters, our apprentices actually take a week off of work, and they go to school for a solid week, and they do that four times a year at least, and that's 160 hours for that particular program, and it's a four-year program as well. But I thought I might ask Bob, and now that I've expounded and didn't really ask a question, but I just thought I'd offer some information for the committee about that program. But I thought maybe Bob or Dan might expound on who sets the criteria and the standards that have to be achieved in these programs to become a journeyman. And, you know, I mean, I'm glad that they mentioned that the journeymen also participate in this training. I think almost all the trades have ongoing education for their members, clear up to construction superintendents and running the jobs. So, but I thought maybe you could expound on the standards and criteria for being a journeyman and really how that's established.
Sure. If I may. Representative Holby, through the chair, each program is administered by a group from labor and management. Certainly, they have authority to establish guidelines within their own standards to a certain extent, but there's another level of it too. The State Apprenticeship Council has established statewide minimum guideline committees, so not only our program and other union programs like ours, but also the our non-union counterparts sit on a statewide committee that establishes minimum guidelines under each occupation. And so it's a pretty broad base, but it's generally established from within the industry. So the industry determines the needs of the industry for training. We also have requirements that are placed by the state and by the federal government. So I think everyone's goal in this process is to establish that whatever training takes place will actually work to the benefit of the apprentice. So by the time they've completed their training, they really are an established journeyman. They have a credential that means something. It gives them portability, so that if they lose employment in with one employer or in one geographic area, they can take the skills that have been developed and move them wherever they need to find work to support themselves and their families.
So. Thank you.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair Witt. We've had previous testimony that has stated that they're really not happy with K through 12, especially grades 11 and 12. Bob, you've served here before. We have less vocational training than when we were here in 93. Do you see, in an ideal world, if you could, what sort of changes would you do in grades 11 and 12 to start introducing them to the apprentice programs, which actually I think are an extremely good thing?
I was hoping somebody would ask that question. If not, I was going to volunteer it anyway. The reason my local union, one of the reasons my local union went to a five, I went through a four-year apprenticeship, then it was moved to five. Why did we do that? It was to teach math, because mm-hmm. they weren't getting it. We have math teachers that we bring into our schools now to teach them why math is relevant. Mm-hmm. Sounds funny, but it's true. They don't. Math teachers that do not understand why geometry is relevant. That's how we bend pipe and frame buildings and everything else. What has happened, and I can do this through my own son's education in Colton. I asked him one time, I said, how are you doing in your shop class? He said, well, we really don't have any. I said, what do you mean? And he says, well, that we don't have any tools and all the machines are broken. They won't fix them because they're too expensive. And so with the cuts in education over the years that we've suffered in Oregon, the first classes to go are shop classes. Now, when I went to school in the Portland Public Schools, I had shop classes in 7th and 8th grade. And then at Marshall High School, 4 years of metal shop, electronics, drafting, and wood shop. 4 years of that. Those programs don't exist. And I could talk a long time about this subject, but it is a sad, sad commentary. One of the reasons I believe and the coordinators believe we're not attracting more people to the trades is they have had no introduction to it at all in high school. They don't know what it's like to run a drill press or a lathe or you know, make a lamp or something like that. And a lot of these kids just aren't going to go to college. I mean, my son was a prime example. That was not an option for him. Luckily, he got an apprenticeship with a utility. He went through that and got another opportunity. He's now in his second apprenticeship. But without that, I don't know what he'd do, frankly. And so, to get to the end of your question, Representative, many of us are thinking this session, just industry people, of talking to the legislature about dedicating money for vocational education. You're spending, what, $6 billion on K-12. Let's start targeting some of that money to some basic voc ed classes for the 40, 50, 60% of these kids that are not going to go on to higher education and bring back why math is relevant and useful and learn basic safety things. And so I'll get off the soapbox. Thank you for the question very much.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe a quick comment about the last answer first, and then I'm back to the comment I wanted to make. You're talking about some of the things that are of great concern, I believe. I've felt for some time that we hold our kids back in high school because we don't have the right mix of programs. And as we sit listening to people talk about workforce development here in this committee, I'm learning a bit more about what we ought to be doing to fill that vacuum. It is a terrible thing to waste that year at age 16 or 17 that so many of our students now see as utterly irrelevant to their lives. That's the comment about that piece. I want to go back and talk a little bit about the mix of practical versus classroom. Now, in your areas, a lot of classroom, I'm sure, is also practically oriented. People actually are doing things with materials that they're going to use on the job. But a bunch of it also is didactic, learning how to do things, learning formulas, learning a whole variety of things that are related to work that you have to do. I have two professional training experiences which I think are relevant to the conversation, and it may have to do something to do with that high school piece too. I'm a lawyer and a psychologist. I went to law school finishing in the early 70s at a time when lawyers had virtually zero in the way of practical experience upon graduation from law school, could pass the bar without ever having seen a client, without ever having done a work in a courtroom or done any of the other, or draft a document except as a part of a class. Later on, I went to psychology school and studied psychology, and in that program, I was in an internship every year where I spent part of every week actually seeing patients. I can tell you that when I finished the psychology program, before I was licensed, I was better at practicing psychology than I ever was after 7 years of private practice as an attorney. It's the mix of didactic versus experiential, which I consider to be crucial. Your programs have obviously found that mix for the professions that you train people for. We need to do a better job in our high schools and in our community colleges where the program isn't aimed at a four-year college but instead aimed at something else, to make certain that we have the proper mix between the didactic in the classroom program and the experiential program out in the field. I don't know if you have a comment about that, but I wanted to bring that up because my personal experience illustrates the point you're making so vividly.
If I may, through the chair, Representative Barnhart, you've really encapsulated what we view as the major advantage of apprenticeship-type training. We have a great opportunity for people to work under the tutelage of a journeyman tradesman out in the field, but there are many things that you can't just learn out in the field. I mean, they've got to get the job done, and they've got to make money for their employer as well. So to sit down and learn electrical or electronic theory, to learn to make the calculations, to develop a run of concentric conduits, to do the math calculations to figure voltage drop in a circuit. Those kind of things are much more easily conveyed in a classroom than they are out in the field. Same with use of the electrical code book. Although you may refer to it constantly out in the field, to really learn the layout and content of the National Electrical Code, a classroom is just a more appropriate place to do it. So by using the combination of those two means of education, we think we wind up with the best kind of training there is. So what you describe in your two educational experiences, I think is a real great way to describe to most of our people why what we're doing is the best way for us to train.
Bob and Dan, we're really fortunate to have very high caliber apprenticeship programs here in the state of Oregon. Could you just briefly share with the committee some of the national and international recognitions that some of our programs have achieved here in Oregon?
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I'll share with the committee is, and it's not anecdotal, in fact, it's a good point for this committee. As Secretary of the Building Trades, in the last 2 or 3 years, for the first time, I have been getting phone calls from large owners and contractors talking about how good the construction workforce is in Oregon. The recent one was Genentech, the engineering firm that is working for Genentech, huge bio pharmacy, whatever they're called, technical, it could be the start of a whole new industry in Oregon. They called and asked the usual questions, you know, labor force, work supply, and they go, well, we're really interested in coming to Oregon. We've heard that you guys have the best workforce in the country. And I said, well, actually, we're the best in the world. But there's a large electrical powerhouse being constructed in your district at Port Westward. A large international contractor who told us a couple months ago that they have built all over the world and have never seen the quality and productivity that they have seen on that powerhouse. Now, Black & Veatch builds a lot of stuff in a lot of places, and that it's just those kind of things that you hear. We also hear anecdotally, because oftentimes our journeymen have to travel out of state because of the economy, and they see in other states perhaps what the quality is like, and oftentimes our people are put in positions of management because the skills we've got. Most of the Intel stuff that's built in Arizona, we actually fly crews down to Arizona to do some of the harder stuff because they don't have the talent, and we do. So you're flying Oregon construction workers to Arizona to build Intel plants. And that's just some of the stuff that I hear, and I'm very proud of it, obviously. And it's a testament to our apprenticeship programs, which are second to none.
I come from a very rural district. We have $8 billion worth of economic development going on in my district. You've named one of the locations that's a hotbed of activity right now. I actually met with some principals of one of the companies that's doing a major development there, and they did the numbers, and they said, you know, you can't crank out enough skilled people to meet our demands. And after talking to a number of the unions, you all guaranteed that you'd be able to supply the labor. Again, the company said, no way, it can't be done. They showed me, look, you know, we build all over the nation, and you can't deliver the trained personnel. You guys delivered it on time, under budget. That company is totally amazed, and last time I knew, they were considering employing your craftsmen around the country. So, in large part, a very, very significant portion of that $8 billion is due to the fact that you are able to deliver not only the people, but the highly prized skills that that these employers want, need, and demand, and a good job for that.
I should mention just one other project. I think it's in Representative Dahlem's areas. Google at the Dalles. They came to Oregon, and they built these facilities. These are massive, by the way, these centers. They build them all over the country. They use a common contractor. We finished that project several months ago. They said they'd never built a facility of that type that quickly and that well done, that now they're going to take two Oregon contractors out in their other facilities, again, using our management to build these facilities. They were so impressed with the job that was done there. So that's quite a compliment from a company like that.
Yes, it was.
Yes, Representative Dahlem.
I am probably only cross-pollination between us and the Education Committee, and I think we ought to trade witnesses for a while.
Go for that.
Try that.
Nice. Thank you very much. I just want to make a comment on
this.
Yes,
please.
Look like this is a real good, successful program we have.
Mm-hmm.
I'm serving also in the Committee of Education and also Higher Ed. We are hearing from the testimony that our current K-12 educational system is irrelevant. Of course, not all, but certainly we have about 25% high school dropout. And this is a big problem. It seems not improving. And did I hear correctly that the only one position is available out of five applicants?
Yes.
Yes. And we might be able to, this could be a one answer of the future, that a lot of applicants, and we were not able to utilize them. I think, in my opinion, we should expand this program to make it more available, you know, turning away the four out of five. This is a real shame, somehow, when you think about it.
Very good. Very good commentary. Anyone else?
Mr. Chair, before we get down, there were two comments I want to make. Representative Gerard brought up the one. One other thing, just for the committee's benefit, that continues to surprise me, and it's kind of off, perhaps, the topic, but what a lot of the programs have done now, they have what they call a boot camp, and they'll bring potential apprentices to the facility for a couple of days, maybe a week, see if they show up on time, things like that. But part of during that week, just before lunch, the potential apprentices are all told when you get back from lunch, we're going to have a drug test. And oftentimes a lot of people don't come back from lunch. My point of this story is that I'm almost to the point where I'm very reluctant to try and steer somebody. The first question I now ask anybody, I don't care who they are, is can you pass a drug test or don't waste my time? We do have mandatory drug testings, oftentimes random drug testing in my industry. So it's a bigger problem than I thought it was. I don't think it's getting any better, and I just thought I'd leave it with the committee. It's just something that one of the reasons we have trouble getting young people is they can't pass a drug test. It's as simple as that. I don't know what to do about that, but I'll share that with you.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so very, very much here for your excellent testimony, and I think you've underscored the fact that without workforce development, there's no economic development. Good job. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'd like to call up next Guy Crawford with the Northwest College of Construction, please.
Seeing triple.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and it's 1,100 members in Oregon and Southwest Washington. And we're here to say, first of all, that our members are both union and open shop, and we're very proud of the union programs that we have the opportunity to be a part of that you just heard about from Mr. Shipwreck. And so we're proud of those programs, and here today to introduce two other programs that we're very affiliated with. The first, the Northwest College of Construction, and Mr. Crawford here to talk about that. And second, Dick O'Connor with the Oregon Building Congress. Workforce development is near and dear to the heart of AGC members, and we are facing a workforce shortage. The average age of a construction worker is over 45, and we are looking towards a baby boom generation that is beginning to retire without a whole lot of folks in the pipeline, and this is critical to the future of our industry. We can't succeed without qualified applicants coming into our apprenticeship programs, without the support of our school system that we are trying to partner with to create opportunities and let them know that this is the kind of industry that creates family wage jobs with benefits. And that's that second point is so critical. Most of our employers provide family, health care, retirement, and in today's environment, that is sometimes unique. They are local jobs, and with the exception of sometimes getting moved around the country, for the most part, these are folks that live here, that have families here, that are able to support those families. Mr. Shiprock talked about the proposal by industry and the support by industry for looking at some dedicated funding for vocational education. We view that as absolutely something to support. That some of our latest numbers show that programs in the last 10 years have declined by over 65%. So programs that used to exist are now non-existent because of school funding, because these are expensive programs, and this is a tremendous opportunity that's just lost. So with that, I'll stop, and again, these are two other programs that just do a great job of reaching out to students and providing important training for the industry.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to... First of all, apologize on behalf of the college president, Dan Graham, for not being here. He had wanted to be here, but there was a college board meeting today that he was required to attend. So he asked me to be here in his stead. My name is Guy Crawford. I'm the Director of Employment Services and Human Resources at the Northwest College of Construction. The Northwest College Construction is less than a year old. We opened our doors last March. As a result of a partnership between the four largest construction professional associations in the Portland metro area, Associated General Contractors, Associated Builder Contractors, the National Utilities Construction Association, and the Home Builders of Metropolitan Portland. And the college was created as a direct result of the lack of skilled construction workers that are available in Oregon right now. As Jessica said, we have a very serious lack, and we anticipate that problem will become much worse as skilled workers begin to retire. What we hear from the employment division is that 40% of skilled construction workers are presently 45 years old or older. It's the feeling of the industry that we have done our part. There are excellent programs administered by the unions, and the contractors' associations have created the Northwest College of Construction, and also have contributed to the Oregon Builders Conference. But the public schools are just not providing the support required. There are some excellent programs available, but generally speaking, those programs are local and oftentimes the result of one individual who has committed to developing these kinds of programs, and they have a limited impact on recruitment. As a regular part of what we do at the college, we spend time at career fairs. We sponsor career fairs. We strive to develop partnerships with schools and junior colleges. Really are committed to doing outreach, but it's our feeling that there needs to be a larger effort made, a more systemic effort made at the state level to coordinate a recruiting process, but also to create programs that will feed students into the industry. And a personal example that I have of the lack of vocational and technical training is with my own son. He's a sophomore at Park Rose High School in Portland. And Park Rose has a beautiful facility. It's a detached building designed as an automotive center. And my son presently attends his ceramic classes in that building and has been committed to a ceramics program. And it's a great ceramics program. But one has to ask how many of those students will find jobs in ceramics. Some of the regional processes that are beginning to take shape that have been successful are programs like the Clark County Skill Center. And this facility actually exists in across the river in Vancouver. But to give you some measure of the lack of vocational programs in the Portland area, students from Park Rose are bused across the river to Washington to attend classes there, vocational classes there. So so there's a very serious need for additional programs in the schools in the Portland metro area, well, and actually throughout the state. We would be happy to support any kind of a statewide system that would create vocational and technical programs. We're presently supporting the creation of a polytechnical charter school in eastern Multnomah County. And that school is created as a result of a partnership between Park Rose, Reynolds, and the Gresham Barlow School District with the support of the Oregon Department of Education. And it looks like it's going to really address the needs for vocational training in that area, but it's a regional effort. And once again, we feel that what we really need is a statewide effort.
Thank you very much. Yes.
If I may also jump in that what part of what the Northwest College of Construction also does is help to administer the open shop apprenticeship programs, which are a counterpart to some of the union apprenticeship programs that the folks at Mr. Shiprack represents also have. And so some of these programs have an open shop set of contractors and folks managing, and then there's a union program as well. And so there's both folks have them. And we would also say that the experience that the electricians have in having five applicants for every opening is unique in the carpenters program, in the laborers program, operating engineers. There are not enough applicants for every position, so there are major openings in that program and those programs for individuals. And while we're thrilled to hear that the electricians have an ample supply of qualified applicants, that is not the case for many other programs and many other trades.
Before I recognize Representative Dahlem, if everyone in the room could just check your cell phones or your Blackberries, that buzzing I think that we're picking up here on the audio is electronic interference. So with that, Representative Dahlem.
We talk about a statewide vocational program, and we heard the numbers of retirees, 40% are the baby boomers. How many jobs are we going to have in the next 10 to 15 years? In the trades, how many are coming?
Well, the construction industry is the most dynamic part of the Oregon's economy right now. I heard a statistic recently that the construction industry has growth equal to the next three segments of the Oregon economy. So clearly, we have a huge need for entry-level workers in this particular area.
I'm trying to get my arms around a number. We had, I believe it was 100,000 jobs on the table in 20 minutes 1 week ago today. And I thought, that's where I'm going with this, is what kind of labor force are we looking at? Do you have any sort of an estimate on numbers?
Currently, the construction industry employs over 100,000.
Half.
Excuse me, sir. Would you please introduce yourself for the record? Thank you.
Sorry,
Mr. Chair.
I'm Dick O'Connor. I'm executive director of the Oregon Building Congress. Currently, has over 100,000 employees. The number of replacement, that is, older people retiring being replaced by younger people, is going to be twice that of the growth aspect in construction. And so the numbers of growth, I'm not an economist, but our economic department in Oregon did in 2002 an estimate of what the construction jobs would be. And they said in 2012 it's going to be about 95,000 is my recollection. Well, it blew right past that to over, I think it's actually 104,000, the last Labor Department report I saw. So it's difficult to forecast the need, and I think Mr. Shiprock alluded to that when asked the question about, you know, how many do you want to take in? But we are facing shortages in many of the trades now, and virtually all of them pay family wage jobs. So this is a huge economic issue for the state. If we don't have the workers to build things, we're going to be in deep trouble.
Additional question?
It's really a follow-up, if I may, on those sets of questions. I'm very aware, I'm on other committees where we're dealing with things like debt, increase in state debt and so forth, and I'm very much aware of the fact that some portion of the construction that's going on in Oregon right now is funded through the increase in the debt that the state is taking on to deal with highways and potentially university buildings and a variety of other things. What percentage of the construction that we're talking about is long-term unsustainable in the sense that it is public enterprises like the state taking on debt to deal with backlogs of maintenance and for a smaller amount of new construction, and how much of it, it looks like it's related to a long-term sustainable economic development. If you have any sense of that, I'd like to hear that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Barnhart, it's our sense. I mean, you have the OTIA program that we anticipate in about 2011 we'll see a sharp decline in the number of projects and therefore jobs, and separately we would strongly encourage the state to make additional investments both from a business and employment standpoint, not to lose the momentum on transportation. And to the extent that you look at additional public investment, say in Connect Oregon or even in your universities, all of which we support as incredibly important and good public policy investments, but the more investments that you make in things like transportation, those have additional economic connections. So if you improve your roads, not only do you keep private jobs here, but you expand the opportunities. And so it's difficult to measure how many of those jobs go away, and it's also tied directly to the economic development and the economy. We are refer to ourselves as a canary in the coal mine. As the economy starts to decline, we are the first to start losing jobs, because if you see your business facing a shortage, you stop doing construction projects. That is not what we are seeing at the moment. We continue to see tremendous growth in the commercial sector. The housing may have started to level out or decline. That is not the experience in the commercial structure. We remain strong. And regardless of what may be the end of a public works strong cycle, and again, we would strongly encourage the Assembly to make additional investments, but even at a decline there, we... because of the upcoming set of retirements, we will still be in need of significant numbers of qualified and well-trained construction workers in the state.
Dick, did you have additional comments?
Yes. I want to talk a little bit about what the Oregon Building Congress has tried to do about the issues related to education, because our goal is to partner with educators to increase the quality and diversity of applicants into the building industry. And I have given to your assistant a packet of information which contains our magazine, Building Futures, which goes out to all the high school students in Oregon and Southwestern Washington who are in construction or construction-related programs. Also has a copy of our annual report, which traces some of the things we do, and several brochures. But I wanted to talk about some of the problems we try to address And we're a small organization, strongly supported by both unions and Open Shop and the Associated General Contractors. There is generally a lack of information about the trades that's available in the schools. Career counselors oftentimes have no idea what's involved in the construction industry. And when I have tried to address that issue with them, I have heard the counselors in the school usually are overwhelmed. They have a caseload of maybe 300 students. They have no time to learn about career information. And, you know, they're lucky if they can talk about apprenticeship to any extent. But a lot of them think that to get into apprenticeship, you need to be, you know, a member of the family, have a father or a brother in the industry. That's long been a criticism, I think, of the industry. But the world has really changed, and now we're really very concerned about the workforce. In addition to the magazine, we do teacher workshops, and Mr. Shiprack alluded to the math workshops that we started about 10 years ago when a sheet metal instructor showed me how he teaches trigonometry to sheet metal workers, and I got it, which was the first time in my life I had ever gotten trigonometry. And I said to the teacher, I said, how would you like to teach this to math teachers? And so he said, I'd love to throw money at the solution rather than the problem. So what we did was start these, and they've been very popular with teachers. And we brought them to the electricians union, the carpenters, the sheet metal, the laborers were involved, plumbers and fitters. And the teachers came away with a new appreciation for the professionalism of the trade workers, the skill required, and how math is used, especially algebra, geometry, and trigonometry. In fact, I think, and I haven't done this, but if we went back in time to figure out why do we teach the math courses we do in the high school, we teach them because they're used to build things. The most common expression by the teachers was, we had no idea. But to their credit, they said, we need more of this. So professional development and workforce needs, I think, is one of the most critical things we can do in the educational arena. So many teachers and educators in general and administrators don't understand that education is part of workforce development. It is so essential, and we have in Oregon a very effective but inefficient system of workforce development. I'm quoting an economist from the state who said, we are effective in the sense that by the time a young person decides they want a career, they get very serious about it. But it's very inefficient because they make that decision in their late 20s rather than coming out of high school and making a smooth transition into an apprenticeship program or a community college program that's focused on technical careers. In the last 50 years in the United States, what we need are more skilled technical workers. The need for less skilled has gone down dramatically. The need for college students has remained almost the same over the last 50 years. It's about 25% we need to go on to college. The schools think that they are successful. They define success by the number of students who go on to college. And the United States has the highest college dropout rate in the world. That's part of the inefficiencies of what we're doing. So we have to do a better job of connecting the workforce and the education. And I salute those who commented on we need to bring testimony to the Education Committee about workforce issues and maybe educational issues to the Workforce Committee, because we really got to start connecting this or we're going to pay a heavy price for it. Another thing we've done is Construction Academy programs for students in the summertime. And we started it in southwestern Washington with ESD 112. And they said this was the most effective pilot they had ever done. And it was simply for this reason. We connected the dots of academics, work, and career information together for all at-risk kids. And they said, your program, which they then copied and replicated for other industries, has resulted in kids who are in danger of dropping out of school, staying in school, taking more math courses, and the reason was they saw and heard what electricians make per hour, or carpenters, or sheet metal workers, and they didn't have to go to college to do it. And they said, I can do that. You know, my family is poor. I don't have enough money. I don't have the resources. And I never liked school. But now they see the reason for it, because the first 30 minutes or an hour every day, we would put kids in a classroom, teach them math, then have them go out on public lands and build the structures using the math that they learned that morning. It became relevant to them. I want to give you a little example of also what we're trying to do with the East County superintendents and the experience we had with Portland Public Schools and experience we had with East County. We wanted to create a charter school in Portland, so we then had to go through the Portland School Board. And Portland had a very clear idea of what the charter laws were regarding charter schools, and they made us adhere to that. In fact, they rejected our initial proposal, which was basically a technical program. We'd let the home high schools teach the academics. We would teach the technical. You do what you do best. We'll do what we do best. Well, they said, no, it has to be a comprehensive. So we redid it to be a comprehensive. And Portland Public Schools has cut many programs of professional technical education over the last 15 years. Benson, which was the premier technical program because of No Child Left Behind, is becoming a school where kids in schools like Roosevelt or Marshall, where Bob went, have failed to make adequate yearly progress. So kids from those schools are now going to Benson. The kids who want technical education in the district are being shutted out by these students from other schools who are attending failing schools. So we said, you only have 107 students in your architecture and construction program. We need more than that. If the construction industry is 5 to 6% of the workforce, 5 to 6% of the students in high school should be in construction. And they only had 107. They have 15,000, or the equivalent of what, you know, we should have is 6% of that, 900. Well, bottom line is Portland has been losing students. And as a result of that, and they saw a charter school as taking more students away from them, they'd get less money. And the bottom line was they can't afford to do that. They're desperate to hang on what they got. We were turned down. Within a week of being turned down, I met with the superintendent of Reynolds, Terry Neisler, superintendent of Park Rose. They want the charter school in their district. And we had a meeting last Wednesday. Mr. Crawford was there. We had superintendents from the four districts or representatives of them. We had school board members. We had representative from the labor unions, from the college. We were all coming together. We were all singing from the same hymnal. We all said, this is a school we want, and we're going to go full speed ahead to do it. It's going to be based on the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham. And that is a beautiful model that you should take a look at and try to replicate throughout the state. It's driven by industry, but all the school districts are on the board of directors. The educators know how to put a school together. Industry knows how to bring support, what the curriculum should be, what the outcome should be. And together, we can create a really dynamic institution where kids are going to get relevant education, and they're going to be more successful. We're going to lower the dropout rate, and we're going to make kids more productive earlier. And I was at a meeting of the Clark County Skills Center on Friday, and he gave some statistics about the success of their students. They take kids from a variety of school districts in the area. They are learning construction, but also about 10 other different areas. The kids who are underperforming, they're able to take 45% of the underperformers and bring them at or above the standards, the standard benchmarks. So they're having a huge, they're almost taking like 50% of the kids and making them much better performers. The kids are successful, they're happy, they see a career future, and, you know, it's a win-win-win for the industry, for educators, and for the students. Now, I'd say that's another model maybe take a look at, and we can, you know, if we can build these things, we can have a profound impact on the future of the state. That's it.
Thank you very much. Representative Baum.
As I started making a list, I'm going to assume for a moment that you're king of the world and are going to tell me what to do. And my colleagues are going to do it. But you're saying that I should bring industry, the trades, the unions, and the schools together.
And contractors, yeah.
And make that as smooth and easy as possible for all the parties.
Right. Okay. You know, we could... if this model, and I'm sure it's going to be successful because everybody who has a role to play is going to be behind it, we could take that model and do it in other areas of the state. But where we ran into kind of a roadblock was Portland was putting up these obstacles to doing it in a way that would guarantee success, in my opinion.
Perhaps, Mr. Chair, we should ask Vicki Phillips, Superintendent of Portland, to come and tell us what they're doing for workforce development. I would really like to hear that.
Maybe
or any other school. I would really like to hear what the education.
Your earlier suggestion, I think, Representative Gollum, that we need kind of cross-pollinization here between a couple of committees is a point very well taken. We're also going to be hearing from Dr. Morrison from the Schellenberg Center here, Sabin Schellenberg, in a couple of minutes. So she may have some information to share with us, too, not trying to put her on the spot by any means.
Here's the why industry is so important, being the driver. Sabin Schellenberg had a program around construction where the unions participated, and they taught a different union program every quarter. The principal who started that program was strongly in support of it. The person who followed was less supportive, and the program has not been as successful. So that's why, to have continuity, you've got to have strong industry support, because they'll make sure that it will be held to a level that produces the results that need to be produced.
Additional questions or comments? I just want to comment on the publication that you've put out, and I think that this would be very attractive to a number of students in our public school systems, and to give them a quick overview of some of the crafts and trades that are available to them as a future career. So I just encourage you to continue trying to make inroads to our public school system. Thank you all very, very much for your excellent testimony.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and thank you to this committee for being willing to hear from the construction industry on this issue.
Thank you, Jessica. Appreciate that very much. Next, I'd like to call up Connie Ashbrook from the Oregon Tradeswomen. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, sir. Good morning. I'm Connie Ashbrook, Director of Oregon Tradeswomen. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to this committee about our perspective on workforce development. And I am very appreciative of your interest in this area and all the other testimony that happened already this morning. I'm the director of Oregon Tradeswomen, and I've been director for 10 years. But prior to that, I worked for 17 years in the building and construction trades. I'm the first female licensed journey-level elevator constructor in the state of Oregon, and the first woman to receive the Oregon Building Congress's Congressman of the Year Award.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I served for 9 years on the Oregon State Apprenticeship and Training Council and also on my trades Joint Apprenticeship and Training Council. I wanted to talk to you about a number of things today. First of all, talking about workforce development and how important that is, and some of Oregon Tradeswoman's accomplishment in that area as a model that others could look at and perhaps replicate. Oregon Tradeswoman's mission is to promote the success of women in the trades through education, leadership, and mentorship. And we work with youth. We work with adult women to get them into pre-apprenticeship and then into employment. And we work with adult women in the trades to build their leadership and bring it full circle so they can be mentors for the next generation.
Connie, if I could interrupt just for a second. Yeah. I think just a little bit of distance from that mic would help.
Okay.
Thank you.
Happy to take direction.
Sorry for the interruption.
What's been very interesting about the testimony today on the apprenticeship and the building and construction trades and addressing Representative Barnhart's concern about long-term sustainability is that there is an equal or greater number of jobs in the trades and maintenance, whether it's with municipal government, with utilities, maintaining hotels, hospitals, schools, roads, residential. So there are, I call these the hidden jobs that that the young people don't learn about. And I want to echo what Mr. Dan Campbell from the Electrical Training Central Electrical Training Center said is we really need to be educating the 80% of young people that are not going on to college so that they can be part of building our state, making sure that the lights go on, that the microphones work, that you have the beautiful furniture and floor and air conditioning systems here, that everything does work correctly. So let me back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the work of Oregon Tradeswomen. We work in partnership with the unions and open shop apprenticeship programs and contractors and with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And you'll see in front of you our annual report, which talks about our accomplishments in this area. Last year, we introduced over 2,700 girls to career and training opportunities in the trades through the hands-on workshops that mean so much to a young person to get a chance to touch it, feel it, smell it, and learn those things through direction from a female role model from the trades so that they can see the model of success that they can look towards. We educated 259 educators about those trades and provided them information that compared trades education to college education and gave their students next steps, ideas of what they could do if they were interested in those careers. Sort of looking at the college catalogs on the counselor's bookshelf, we wanted to provide apprenticeship information there as well. We introduced over 900 women to career and training opportunities in the trades, and then served 88 women through our trades and apprenticeship career class, our pre-apprenticeship program, and helped 79 women achieve careers in the trades. So that's an overview of our work, and you'll see the amount of money it took and where the money came from. We have tremendous support from all types of apprenticeship programs and contractors, as well as different government agencies. And and to help us do our work. I also have for you a little bit more in detail about our accomplishments and the class itself, the pre-apprenticeship class that is like the boot camp that the gentlemen were referring to, and then also the education of young people. Also in your packet is the document we developed called Apprenticeship at a Glance. This shows the 33 different union and open shop apprenticeship programs in the Portland area, and you can see the qualifications to get into it, the selection method, fees, when the class is held, the length of time the training is, the wages. So just gives a broad overview because these are very, each apprenticeship program runs its own system and they're very separate from each other, and so we wanted to get the information in one document. I also wanted to invite you to come see trades education for yourselves at our Women in Trades Career Fair. We'd be delighted to host you and give you a tour of the event. We already have over 1,000 young people signed up from all over the state to come, 500 middle schoolers on Thursday, 500 high school girls on Friday, and we expect over 500 adult women and families on Saturday. So we'd love to have you come. And here is a review of last year's event. I wanted to close by echoing again what Mr. Dan Campbell says, is that we're really looking for your help to emphasize education for all young people, not just those going on to college. And of course, we're very interested in seeing a high percentage of the young people that are being educated be young women. Because of some of the historical biases and inequities and our change in our society, we're still working together with all of our partners to educate women and girls that these jobs even exist and that they're welcome to enter them. And so we would look for your help to support and encourage the direction of the workforce diversity as well as the education of in the trades, and both to hold contractors accountable for their performance in this area and to reward good performance. So thank you very much. I welcome your questions and thank you for your attention.
Connie, thank you so very, very much. Before we open it up for questions from the committee, I'd like to recognize Representative Shields, who's joined us here for your presentation. Questions for Connie or comments? Yes, Representative
Holvey.
Holvey, thank you.
That happens occasionally after 50. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, that hurts, Representative Holvey. Ouch.
I'm speaking from experience. Connie, thank you so much for being a part of this presentation today, because I think your organization has been filling a gap or a need that's existed for a long time. And, you know, I've worked with your organization in the past, and, you know, it has not always been easy to, you know, recruit from, you know, sitting in my chair, I suppose, sometimes women into the trades. And I think a lot of that is historically been cultural. And I'm just really thrilled that you've put so much effort in this, and you deserve a great deal of recognition in this state for what you have done. But speaking specifically about that, do you find that, you know, that it's certain trades may be more successful at recruiting women than others? And can you tell me whether you think that's cultural or the physicalness of the work that tends to make some women shy away? And how do you see overcoming those barriers, if there are any?
Well, Well, I'm in close connection with similar programs around the country. So during those conversations, we talk about, okay, which program has the most women and which program is doing well. And it's very interesting how different it is around the country. And the one single factor that we see that is different is how welcoming and responsive the training director is. Has had the most influence in the numbers of women in the program, from what I can see. When women come in our door, they do mostly think about becoming electricians and carpenters because that's what they see on television through this old house. And by the time they graduate, they become roofers and painters and sheet metal workers and operating engineers and the whole gamut, because we partner with those programs to educate our women about what those traits mean. I think we need, in order to recruit more women and girls into these industries, we do need to combat some of these stereotypes about who makes a successful construction worker. And so we really work hard to get images of women out there doing constructions to combat some of the stereotypes that women don't do this work and aren't successful in it. But you'll, as Mr. Campbell said, women can do very well in industry and make highly successful construction workers and make money for their companies, and the companies are delighted with those that do well in the industry.
Additional questions or comments? Yes, Vice Chair Lim.
As I scanned through this information, I found out here about 39% of ethnicity, and that's a quite large percentage. And how that happened to be? And can you explain to
me? Well, again, Representative Lynn, thank you very much for that comment, and we're very proud of our success in this area. And it does mean that success does come from dedicated resources to reaching out to minority communities and making sure we talk to community organizations that work with people of color, making sure we advertise in publications that serve people of color, and making sure that our images are always representative of a wide variety of ethnic groups. And that has been part of our success. We have a tradeswoman of color support group that has been meeting twice a year. We hope to be meeting quarterly. And that also provides a chance for networking and support because, as you can imagine, it's hard to be a woman construction worker when you're 3 to 5% of the workforce, but it's even harder to be a woman of color in the workforce when you're not even statistically less than 1%. And then for men of color, it's about 8%. To reflect back on Mr. Shipwreck's comments about the South Waterfront, he had reflected on the high numbers, but many of those numbers were entry-level laborers who were not even into an apprenticeship program. So they did not reflect the diversity of people in apprenticeship programs that were getting credentialed training that would lead to a lifelong career, but were more day laborers or general laborers, where it didn't include the training that leads to a lifelong career in construction.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Chair Witt, for allowing me to sit in. I just wanted to be here in solidarity and support of County's testimony. As some of you know, I worked for Oregon Tradeswomen during the interim session, and just wanted to make a comment to all of you that seeing the organization from the inside, it's an incredible service delivery organization, but just as importantly, an incredible advocacy organization, and often willing to take courageous stands to change the conditions that keep women in a small percentage of the construction trade. So we just want to say thanks for your work.
Thank you, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Representative Shields. I'm glad you could join us. Connie, I hope that
this card gets around to the public school systems in the state. Are you working on that?
We send that card to over 900 educators around the state and Southwest Washington. And we do have schools coming from all over the state to our event, and we just wish we could serve more young people because we have slots for 1,000, and I believe we could serve 3,000 if we had the space and the workshops and the ability.
Yes, Representative Dolan.
You have slots for 1,000 and capacity. How many do you have in those slots?
Right now we have about 900 students signed up from around the state to come. And so we expect to ultimately serve somewhere between 1,200 and 1,000 youth at the career fair. And we offer bus scholarships as well for the schools because that's part where their budgets are pinched. And you'll see that many of the supporters on the back of this, our annual report, are helping to pay for those bus scholarships. And these are industry supporters that also agree how important it is to be able to bring the young people there. And I do believe we have some, I wish I had brought the map that showed where the schools are coming from, but I do believe we have students coming from your area.
Which school, if I might ask?
Well, I can make sure I send
like
you that information.
Thank
yeah.
you.
But looking at the map, I know we have some in that area.
Connie, just want to recognize the pioneering work that you have done in the building and construction trades. It's never easy to be first. But the role model that you've provided is extremely important to women across our state and even region-wide. I know you're very well known, as is your work and your programs. Thank you for all of that. And 1,000 women who are going to be at your trades fair owe so very much to you, as does the future success of our ability as a state to meet demand for labor. Thank you so very much. And thank you for your excellent testimony.
Well, thank you very much for your interest and your attention today. And again, you could have a very strong influence on making sure that the open doors open wider and wider, and that equal opportunity is a strong part of the workforce development in our state. So thanks again for inviting me here today.
Thank you.
And your kind words.
Last on today's schedule will be Dr. Morrison from the Sabin-Schellenberg Center. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. I'll make sure that... Is that... Oh.
That's good.
Thank you very much for inviting me here this morning. My name is Cindy Morrison. That's what my name tag says. Principal at Sabin-Schellenberg Professional Technical Center. Until 18 months ago, I was a teacher, administrator, a community college associate dean in Oklahoma, Florida, Colorado, Massachusetts, Mississippi, and Washington. 2 years ago, I took a sabbatical after being principal of the lowest achieving school in Washington State. And our staff turned that around, and we became a demonstration school. So the University of Connecticut invited me to work with failing schools to find out what was going on in high schools. Instead of looking at the negative side, we looked at the positive side, and we sought what was going and doing well throughout the country in all different regions. The Sabin-Schellenberg Professional Technical Center kept popping up, and if someone 2 years ago would have said you are moving to Portland from an island in the Puget Sound and you're going to be principal of this school, I would have said that one might bay at the moon. My name tag now says Cindy Morrison, principal at Sabin-Schellenberg, and I finally get it. As a comprehensive high school principal, everyone needed to read Beowulf. Everyone needed to go to college. And I finally get it. We're going to talk this morning, or I would like to speak this morning, about making rigor, relevance, and relationships a reality. The Sabin Schellenberg Professional Technical Center was originally constructed in 1967 as the Owen Sabin Vocational Skills Center. The philosophy of career education and the programs offered in the North Clackamas School District have grown to include the Ben Schellenberg Professional Technical Center, which is formerly the old McLaughlin Middle School, the Land Lab, located just adjacent to Clackamas High School, and our forestry program is located at Camp Withicum, the National Guard Armory. 21 career elective programs offer 90 classes on all four of these locations. It's also noteworthy that 98% of our staff members have come from industry with at least 5 years of industry experience. During the 2005-2006 school year, the Sabin Schellenberg Professional Technical Center served over 3,400 students from Milwaukee, Rex Putnam, and Clackamas High Schools in grades 9 through 12. Training and workforce development is Sabin Schellenberg's priority. This unique component of the high school experience offers students in the North Clackamas School District the opportunity to explore career and technical education, developing connections between industry and education is one of the essential steps to reach this goal. One path to do this is creating and maintaining training programs that will prepare our students with the technical, academic, and workplace attitudes critical, as we've heard this morning, to meet the aging workforce in Oregon. Excellence through application is the first thing you see when you walk into our school, and it reflects the commitment of our four R's. This time we're spelling them correctly: rigor, relevance, and relationships. The three R's when I went to school were reading, writing, and arithmetic, and we didn't spell them right the first time, but we're getting it right this time. By enrolling in career electives, students learn to use the tools that they're going to need and apply the skills that they will need post-high school. All employers, as we have heard this morning, want and need qualified applicants with soft skills to be ready to work. They need drug-free applicants, applicants who understand learning is a continuous process and can adapt to change. Collaborative and productive relationships with educators on a regular basis is also essential. One of the most successful examples of how programs are working at SSE, as we colloquially call it, is our building trades program. In the spring of 2004, my predecessor, who you heard about this morning, wanted to reorganize the program as it had developed into probably 10 or 12 students. There were no tools. There was no space, and they were, frankly, making spaghetti spoons. That not much was going on. So what happened was we employed the advice of the tradesmen and created an advisory committee to provide those daily routines. We employed and were able to get a substitute status for those tradesmen. We had 18 students in the program the first year. That would have been the fall of 2004. And we had representatives from the Electrical Training Center, the Pacific Iron Workers and Employees Apprenticeship, Regional Training Centers, Painters, Drywall and Allied Trades Apprenticeship, the Willamette Carpenters Association, and they did rotate through that process from quarter to quarter. From the fall of 2005 to the present, the enrollment has grown enough to separate buildings 1, building 2 and 3 into separate courses. with the enrollment. We now have upwards to 78 students in the program, and we're getting ready to do forecasting this week with the three high schools, and we expect that position to grow into a full-time position. It was half-time. It is now three-quarter time. And what we've done is we flipped the process. So our students no longer have the representatives from the apprentice programs come in to teach the classes. They are now going out. They're the tentacles reaching out into the actual workforce. They are paired with a mentor or a community consultant to develop the soft skills that are going to be needed for employability. A job shadow or internship program is developed with our internship coordinator, which we have added, to work with one of the apprenticeship centers. Underscoring all of this excellence is the quality assurance, which is the recognition from the Oregon Department of Education. And during the 2005-2006 school year, all of our 21 programs were recognized with quality assurance. And that's a process that occurs every 3 years. In your packets, I have given you the new course catalog, I believe. And on page 9, I put a little flag there. You'll see the trades program flagged with an intro, level 1 and level 2 and level 3. And then the flag at the rear of the document also shows you all of the partnerships that we have throughout all of our 21 programs. To conclude, I would just like to summarize by saying that creating relevant programs with academic rigor and strong skills linked to the workforce are dependent on what we have heard this morning, and I can't underscore them enough. The sustainability of funding, reaching out and making a strong connection with community partners, having those tradesmen as part of our programs and part of our advisory committees. Every student being required to participate in focused electives sparks another interest in other careers. We have students that are in automotive technology, for instance, that are doing internships in the trades because they all are working together. We really need that cross-pollination that you talked about, and I would certainly support not only our model, which has a link to the home high school, as well as the other models that you have heard about, whether it be the ESD model in Washington or the Cal model that you heard spoken of this morning.
Thank you, Dr. Morrison.
Please call me Cinda.
I apologize for looking to the clock in the door, but I do have an appointment very shortly. One of the things that I would really like to know about in your program, you talked about bringing in the trades and the practitioners, I would suppose union members. How did you work that through teacher standards and practices? What was the process?
The process was that our teaching assistant has his certification to teach as well. So we had a full-time teaching assistant that did the rudimentary kind of role-taking, entering grades, and then we certified the tradesmen through TSPC to be substitutes. And so they rotated in, and then Mr. Brown served as the stable force that way.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes, Representative Girard.
Just one quick question. Thank you for coming. I appreciate your testimony. I appreciate the model of your school. Do you do drug testing?
No, we don't.
Would you like to be able to do drug testing?
Oh, you're putting me on the line. It's a very controversial subject. Knowing that from a personal standpoint, my husband owned a manufacturing business for over 25 years, and knowing that is a real problem in the workforce. I believe that when students are out doing an internship, they need to follow the practices of the workforce. In the public school system, I think that that's a can of worms that I don't want to tackle, but I think when they once they leave and they are actually out doing their internship or their job shadow, they need to meet those standards of that work, that particular workforce. And so I would support that very much.
Cinda, thank you so very much. Certainly appreciate the fact that we have a practitioner here that's trying to make it vocational technical schooling more available to our students here. And I wish you the very best of luck in pursuit of this this line of education. And certainly we appreciate your making yourselves available to us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee.
All right, before we adjourn, on Wednesday, we will be having a public hearing and possible work session on House Bill 2447 that declares January 13th Korean American Day, and House Joint Resolution 12 that encourages Oregonians to join in the celebration of that date. We had earlier testimony last week on both of those. With that, our committee stands adjourned until Wednesday. Thank you all very much.
I don't even want to shake your hand only because I don't want to get
yesterday was the first day I did not cough.
So how early did you get up this morning?
Yeah,
right out here?
Well,
so it wasn't you.
No, just unfortunate I didn't realize that a week ahead of time.
Well, oh, okay.
If they're available, maybe later on.
The kids actually made it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I have an apprenticeship bill.
Okay.
That I just dropped. It's probably going to get.
Yeah. Why don't we keep it
signed to this committee?
Do you think it would be all right to put it in the? I assume you want to go.
I know this guy.
And they'll certainly.
So yeah, if you're all right with that, and I'd like to put it into the public record if that's okay. Great.
They
thank
offer
you.
A different perspective.
All right, thanks, Paul.
We work with all these organizations here, which is interesting. So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, let's see here. I decided I'm hungry all of a sudden. So it sounds like maybe you had not the best of weekend.
Yeah. You know, I got on Friday night, Oh, I feel that good. I never get sick.
Yeah.
I don't feel that great. And, yeah, that just sort of went downhill from there.
And boy.
Yeah, I'm trying to
be able to sleep at night.
Not. Yeah, you know, it hasn't, today has actually been the worst thing with the coughing. And, you know, I don't feel that bad, but it's like, I can't seem to get any words out or breathe properly.
I've been having problems with blocked ears and sinuses and all this stuff. So on, what was it, Friday? I think it was Friday, yeah, Friday. Judy made an appointment with a doctor for me, and I didn't know. She goes, "You never go." And she said, "So your next appointment."
Oh, that's so good.
Talk about the head bone and the tailbone connected. The guy, he goes, "You got acid reflux disease, and that's what your sinus problems are all about." I went,
"What?
What?
What does that have to do with one another?"
And he showed me. He gave me this this diagram of the human body and all the tubes and whatnot. And